Okay, good morning. Can people hear me okay? Good. So it's a pleasure to be here for various values of here. So I'd like to thank the organisers for the opportunity to speak and then dive straight in with a question because the title's a bit unwieldy. So if we consider symmetric integer matrices, and here for integers I just mean the normal rational integers for now, I'm interested in which ones have all their eigenvalues in this closed interval minus 2, 2, which might seem a strange choice. So to explain why this particular interval, take a detour into polynomials for a bit. So if you take a univariate polynomial, take it to be non-constant, and think of it as a product of its roots, factors rather than this sort of monomial form, you can define the Marlowe measure in various ways, but the convenient one here is this. So it's the product of the greater of 1 and the absolute value of each root of this polynomial, or if you prefer, it's the product of all the absolute values which are greater than 1, then the entry product will just be 1. And the obvious thing you can say about this, whatever it is, it's at least 1, since all of the things you multiply are at least 1. And if it is 1, then in fact all the roots must have absolute value, at least at most 1, so they're in the closed unit disk. But as stated, for just a general polynomial, there's not really much going on here. If you hand me some value lambda, I can always hand you back a polynomial whose Marlowe measure is lambda. Z minus lambda will do the job, so that's not particularly challenging. So if we maybe save this and then change the game slightly. So make it an integer polynomial, and just for convenience we'll make it monic. Obviously the Marlowe measure doesn't change, and if it was greater than 1 before, it's still greater than 1 now, because this is a special case. But you get a slightly stronger result for the values where the polynomials give Marlowe measure of 1. Here all the roots of the polynomial now must lie on the unit circle, not just within the unit disk. So in particular, if you're a cyclotomic polynomial, then you have to get Marlowe measure 1 and vice versa. So we know which polynomials take Marlowe measure 1. So then the obvious question is, well, what about the other ones? So for the general case, you could get whatever you wanted. Maybe things are a bit more difficult for the integer polynomials. So the question or the conjecture, depending on how you want to look at these things, is if I take one of these non-cyclotomic examples, so where the Marlowe measure is assumed to be not 1, can it be arbitrarily close to 1? If that wasn't the case, then what would happen? There'd have to be some sort of lower bound which prevents you from reaching arbitrarily small values. There'd be some lambda, such that if your Marlowe measure is greater than 1, in fact it's greater than lambda. And so there's some sort of distinction between cyclotomic polynomials and a non-cyclotomic example. Something separates these two. And conjecturally, this is the case. The best example anyone's managed to come up with is this lambda naught value. This is 1.17-ish. You take this degree 10 polynomial. It has one real root of absolute value greater than 1, and it's obviously the value is then this value lambda naught. This polynomial was known to Lehmer back in 33, I think. And no one's done better in 75 years. So the hope is that the reason we can't do better is because it's actually the case that there are no better rather than because we're just not trying hard enough. And if you look at the plot that we have here, you can see this is kind of almost a cyclotomic polynomial. So I said that necessarily, if you want to be cyclotomic, all the roots have to lie on the unit circle here. That's almost the case, but you have a couple of values off the disk which contribute some greater than 1 products. And this seems like the best way or the most likely way to find something with a small Marlowe measure. The more roots outside the circle, the more products you're going to multiply, so obviously the larger it's going to get. So what you want is somehow kind of an almost cyclotomic polynomial, as few roots outside this circle as possible. Trouble is, if I give you a cyclotomic polynomial and say, give me an almost cyclotomic one, it's not at all obvious how to get from one to the other. If you mess around with the coefficients, the roots could change a lot, and if you mess around with the roots, well, it's not going to be an integer polynomial anymore. So what I want, really, is some kind of structure we can exploit which will give us something more to play with and some way of generating these good but not quite cyclotomic polynomials. So for that, we come back to matrices, which has been the point of this talk. So starting off with an integer symmetric matrix, you can take the characteristic polynomial, then make a substitution for z plus 1 upon z for the variable of the characteristic polynomial. That'll be have coefficients from z to the n down to z to the minus n, so you top it back up by z to the n, you'll get a degree 2n polynomial. And this then explains why I care about this particular interval. If all the eigenvalues of the matrix you started with were in this closed interval minus 2, 2, then you get a cyclotomic polynomial when you go for this transformation. So the obvious thing to do is then describe this matrix A as a cyclotomic matrix. So cyclotomic matrix in, cyclotomic polynomial out, but the trouble is, we know what cyclotomic polynomials are, so this kind of seems like it hasn't completely bored us anything. The point is that we can somehow mess around with these matrices and get something a bit better. And this is really what makes it tick. This is a theorem of Cauchy. This is his interlacing theorem. So if you start off with a n by n matrix, it'll have n eigenvalues, not necessarily distinct, but certainly in this case they're going to be real, and you can put order them, least to greatest. if you delete a given row and column from that matrix, you'll get obviously a smaller matrix, which will have one less eigenvalue. But perhaps the surprising thing is that these values then, as what's described as interlaced with the original eigenvalues. So if you know bounds on the original ones, you get bounds on the new ones you get by deletion. So maybe we keep hold of that one. Interesting is if you then turn it on its head and do it backwards. So if you start off with the cyclotomic matrix, you know, the smaller one, you know that its eigenvalues are going to lie within this interval. If you're then sort of, you know, deleting rows and columns, you then add one back in, so you sort of grow your matrix to something larger, the interlacing theorem will still hold because this new matrix will induce the original one as a submatrix. So the eigenvalues of the smaller one have got to interlace with the eigenvalues of the larger one. So in particular, the vast majority of the eigenvalues of the new larger matrix are constrained to fall within the interval mu1, mu n minus 1, which is supposed to be by assumption between minus 2, 2. And the worst thing that can happen is that, you know, a couple of the eigenvalues fall out of the interval. So in some sense, if you keep growing cyclotomic matrices, if you're really lucky, you get another cyclotomic, and if you're not, you'll get something that isn't, but only just fails. So whereas for the polynomials, we kind of couldn't see how to proceed here, this kind of growing procedure lets you explore through the space of cyclotomics and then eventually find, you know, the non-cyclotomic examples. And as soon as you hit a non-cyclotomic, you can stop, see whether it gives an interesting Marlin measure, and so on. This all motivates an obvious way to proceed computationally and just sort of, you know, solve with some initial matrices, see what you get. I'm claiming that, you know, these things are interesting, got to prove actually something exists at all. So here are five not particularly great matrices. They're all, you know, cyclotomic, their eigenvalues work, but they're not that exciting perhaps. But the interlacing theorem tells us that this then forces the entries of any cyclotomic matrix to also be one of these five values. For diagonal entries, this is immediate. You just keep deleting rows and columns to just left with that diagonal entry. It's got to be one of these because it's supposed to be constrained by the original one. And then if you look at the off-diagonal entries, you can delete all but two rows and columns and then look at the possible choices for the diagonals, and this will constrain the off-diagonal ones as well, at least in the rational integer case, to be one of these. And in fact, if you know one cyclotomic matrix, you know loads. Obviously, if you take a block diagonal matrix, if you want the eigenvalues of the whole matrix, you just take the eigenvalues of the respective blocks. So if you had a, you know, block diagonal matrix, each block cyclotomic, you get something that's bigger than cyclotomic. But this kind of feels like cheating. You know, really, the only interesting thing here is the indecomposable ones. These will be the building blocks for any larger cyclotomic matrix. The nice thing about that is that in this sense, 2 is already a big number. The only way you can have a cyclotomic matrix with an entry of 2 or minus 2 is if you take one of these small examples. Anything larger which has one of these will necessarily decompose into blocks where one of the blocks with the 2 in it will be either dimension 1 or dimension 2. So what we're all we're really looking at here is matrices of entries from 0, 1 or minus 1. And similarly, we have this idea of, you know, this growing procedure should eventually, you know, stop. So you only really care about the biggest examples, because if I tell you the large examples, you know all the sub-matrices are going to behave themselves. So if you think of a matrix being obtained by deletion of rows and columns as being contained in an upper one, then a maximal one is one which has the property that any attempts to grow it necessarily give you either something non-cyclotomic or a cyclotomic which decomposes into blocks. So everything larger is either non-cyclotomic or decomposable. So those are kind of the interesting ones, these are the maximal ones, and then if I know all of them, then in theory I know every other cyclotomic matrix as well by just taking subgraphs of those and then, you know, unions of blocks of them. And it turns out that this process won't carry on forever. There are infinite families of examples, but if you give me any non-max example, I can always go find something which contains that, but is itself maximal. So that's sort of taking a few things away, because obviously, you know, now restricting it to these indecomposable maximal examples, but to get something back, if you know one cyclotomic matrix, in fact you know lots, so if you take just the orthogonal group here of signed permutations, conjugation by one of these doesn't change the eigenvalues. So, you know, anything in this equivalence class will be, you know, also cyclotomic if the original was cyclotomic, or not if the other one wasn't. And negating a matrix just negates all its eigenvalues, so we have a slightly broader notion of equivalence here, whereby two matrices will be equivalent if they're conjugates, or if they're conjugate up to sign, at least. So what this all kind of boils down to in the end is what we want is the maximal indecomposable cyclotomic symmetric minus 1, 0, 1 matrices up to this equivalence relation. That'll basically tell everything you want to know about cyclotomic examples. But matrices aren't actually all that great to work with, so instead of thinking about matrices, introduce another structure, which is the a charged sign graph. So if you think normally if you have a matrix of zeros and ones and zeros and diagonal, you can think of this as an adjacency matrix for some graph, Well, you can generalize this slightly since we only have, you know, plus one, minus one, or zero now. So the diagonal entries give you essentially a charge on the vertices of the graph. So normally zero diagonal, you just get some point. But if you have one or minus one on the diagonal, then you, you know, attach a positive or negative value to the actual points. And then the off-diagonal entries should tell you what edges you have in your graph. But here now we have two possible types of edge. So if there's a, you know, off-diagonal entry of one, you get an edge. But if you have a minus one, we think of this as being sort of assigned a negative edge between the two. So armed with all that, we can actually try and copy over some of the ideas. So in decomposable matrices, will now be the same as connected graphs. So if it decomposes into blocks, you just get connected components of graphs. If you can't embed the matrix in a larger cyclotomic example, then the graph you've drawn can't be embedded in a larger cyclotomic graph. This makes sense. You just take the matrix of that graph, and it would be a supermatrix if it works, so it can't. If you permute the rows and columns of a matrix, so this is half of our current operation, then you just relabel the vertices of the graph. So for convenience, we just ignore vertex labeling. That's not quite true for later work, but certainly in the integer case, it behaves itself. And then this idea of conjugating by these sort of signed permutations, this just switches all the edges. So if you take a vertex with some set of signs, then applying one of these matrices to its representation will give you a new graph where the patterns are switched, so solid edge goes dotted and so on. So this is all of the first few examples. If you look at charge examples, you get kind of three graphs which just happen to work. So these are 7 and 8 vertexes, respectively. So maybe keep hold of those. Any other charge example has to fall into one of these two infinite families. So this starts at 4 vertices, so then you just get a charged tetrahedron, and then you can grow it by inserting these neutral vertices in the middle in this kind of weaving pattern. And then since by equivalence we can assume at least two of the charges are positive, we then either get two more or two more negative at the other end. And this is literally, you know, these are up to equivalence, this is all you can do for charged examples. Things are a bit stranger but not much more complicated for uncharged. So you get this 14 vertex star-like structure. Again, it just happens to work. And similarly, you get a 16 vertex, this is a charged hypercube, which again has the property that, you know, all of its eigenvalues will be minus 2, 2, and any attempt to grow this will not behave itself. Does that work? There we go. And otherwise, again, apart from these two sporadic examples, everything has to fall into a certain infinite family. In this case, it starts at 6 vertices. So what we've got here, the idea is that the two end vertices A and B should be identified, so things sort of, you know, making a torus. And then you have the same sort of weaving structure that we saw before for the charge example, but now instead of it stopping at either end, it sort of loops around. So you can get a nice example of that. So this is the 24 vertex case. So then armed with all of these, you can go off and you can, you know, ask, you know, so what Mahler measures then fall out of the non-cyclotomic examples. So given a cyclotomic one, you can grow it to a non-cyclotomic. This will either be minimal or not, and if it isn't, shrink it back down. And eventually you get a special case of this conjecture. It turns out that the associated polynomials of any matrix constructed in this way will always have Mahler measure at least this lambda naught, like mentioned earlier, this 1.17-ish value. This, unfortunately, doesn't settle the problem completely, because, of course, there are polynomials which do not arise as the associated polynomials of these structures. But it's certainly, you know, it's a broad case of them. Here's an example of why this bound is strong. So we can actually achieve this lambda naught value. Here are two charged examples. So these are 5 vertex graphs that give you a degree 10 polynomial. Or there's a 10 vertex uncharged example, which also gives you this lambda naught value. So that gets you, you know, most of the way, but it doesn't give you everything. So I thought I'd set off and see, you know, where else you might be able to find structures like this. And I think the key observation is that the interlacing theorem is not special to, you know, integer symmetric matrices. It works for any Hermitian matrix. So the particular Hermitian matrices I looked at, I took the ring of integers of imaginary quadratic extensions. So, you know, take the square root of some negative number, you'll either get Z adjoin that or Z adjoin half plus L over 2 or whatever. And obviously we only care about the square-free examples here. In this case, the diagonal entries are still going to be real integers from these rings. They're going to have to just be the 0, 1, plus minus 1, plus minus 2 as before. And you get a constraint on the off-diagonal entries, which, in the context of a quadratic extension, just turns out to be a constraint on the norm of the entry of the matrix. So in particular, any off-diagonal has to have norm at most 4. And that does a lot of work for you. So if D is sufficiently negative, in fact, there's nothing to be said at all. The only entries of norm at most 4 are 0, 1, minus 1, 2 and minus 2, so it just reduces to the integer case, so nothing to see. And for minus 15 and minus 11, you only get norm 4 and norm 3 edges, respectively. If you then try and grow these, you very rapidly find there's only a finite supply of new indecomposable matrices with those as edge labels. So here I've kind of abused the idea of charged sign graph a bit. So now I've got essentially a labeled graph. So you know, there's a value on each edge. And again, these will be working up to some sort of equivalence, which gets slightly broader. You can now take complex conjugation. And for some, whenever you have roots of unity in your ring, you can also conjugate by those rather than just by the normal sign permutations. But that's all you get there. These are, you know, optical equivalency only classes. Unless this sounds, you know, that things are going too well, for the remaining cases, minus 1, 2, 3, and 7, you have a lot of possible entries in the matrix or a lot of possible edge labels for Lagrasse. The norm 3 and the norm 4 entries don't actually cause too much difficulty. You can rule those out. There are only finitely many, again, families for these. But if your ring emits a norm 2 or a, you know, non-rational integer norm 1 entry, it turns out you can exhibit infinite families of new cyclotomics. The other problem is if you just try and naively go about this growing procedure, you rapidly run into sort of a combinatorial explosion. And even if you try and do it sort of non-naively and you come up with lots of good ideas, you still get stuck, you know, a little bit earlier than you'd hope to actually say anything intelligent. So having made the ring, you know, has made life harder, I've switched to making the problem slightly easier. There's an observation for the integer case that these maximal cyclotomics don't just have all their eigenvalues in this closed interval, they in fact achieve the bounds. So every eigenvalue turns out to be either minus 2 or 2 exactly, you don't get anything in between. So conversely, if you hand me a cyclotomic matrix with eigenvalues within the interval, not all at the edges, somehow you can always grow it until you reach this kind of extreme value. So I describe these as 4 cyclotomic matrices because if you square the matrix representation, you just get 4 lots of the identity. And as I say, for the integers, it works, and it turns out that given there's only finite many for minus 15 and minus 11, you check for those also turn out to always have this property of maximal cyclotomic is the same thing as 4 cyclotomic. And if you put that structure on, it's now a lot easier to actually sort of compute with these things. And I said it's feasible, it's not necessarily easy, but you know that if you're trying, eventually you're going to grow to a situation where every vertex has essentially a weighted degree of 4, or every row or column in your matrix has, you know, the sum of the norms of its entries being 4. So since that's got to happen, you might as well, you know, graft in those new neighbors first. You sort of find a canonical representation of your matrix. So the advantage is you cut out a factorial rather than the permutations, you know, giving you many possible, you know, fragments of the same equivalence class. You kind of narrow down to one good representation early on. So if you sit down and you sort of, you know, try many various things, eventually you can get a classification. So these are most of the sporadic examples. Some particularly useful work here. I guess the only thing to notice is that some of them are in color because I now have, you know, more weight 1 edges. So I think here green is one root of unity, and then red will be its complex conjugate. This is everything under 8 vertices. Nothing particularly exciting happens. And then for minus 3, you get a couple of larger examples as well. The one on the right is ugly, but ugly for a reason. The one on the left is ugly because I can't find a better drawing. There are 6 of the 10 factorial possible colorings, and then you can arrange the points however you want. So if you want to find a better one for me, I'll be happy for someone to do that, but that's the most symmetric version I've come up with for now. And then again, you get infinite families. So in the cases of minus 3 and minus 1, you can introduce these norm 1 roots of unity, and it turns out that you'll get an inequivalent version of these toroidal tessellations that we saw before. You can always switch away most of the complex edges. You get left with at least 4. However, you always have one of these complex hourglasses. So you get essentially 2 families for each value of k. You either have the original rational integer case or you get these complex versions. The norm 2 edges also allow you to do something similar to the charged example. So whereas before we sort of managed to end the structure by joining it up or by attaching charges, now you can attach a single vertex linked on with a pair of norm 2 edges. In fact, all you need is that AA conjugate and BB conjugate are equal to 2. So you could take, you know, completely different rings here, or you could take the real case or whatever. But certainly in the context of these imaginary quadratic extensions, you always get a new family. And for minus 7, you in fact get 2 in equivalent families because the equivalence relation doesn't quite make them the same. There's a stronger equivalence relation in minus 1 and minus 2, which gets you there. And then you get a hybrid of the two. You get the charges at one end and the weight 2 edges at the other. So again, all we really need is that this A has, you know, norm 2. So armed with all of these, I have complete classification of the four cyclotomics. And what I have, I guess, is this problem that's left. So I started with a question that at least two people knew the answer to. I'm hoping someone can help me find the answer to this one. So conjecturally, these maximal cyclotomics are precisely the ones that are squared of four. So in other words, my classification, I hope, of these four cyclotomics is in fact everything I'm going to see. But I have no reason necessarily to believe why that should work, other than the fact that it seems too good to not be true. One direction is easy. It's not exactly a brute force calculation because it's too many things to check, but it's up to equivalence, it's fairly easy to demonstrate. Going the other way, as I said, it's true in the integer case, which means that for any sufficiently small d, so certainly for less than minus 17, which is the integer case, and then for the two cases which I was able to verify, it still holds. But as a note of caution, it's not true if you restrict your attention to just the adjacency matrices of graphs. If we narrow it down to zero diagonals and then 0, 1 on the off diagonal, you can ask what the cyclotomic examples are here. And these are some fairly familiar objects. So these are precisely the cyclotomic graphs in the usual sense. These are maximal in the sense that if you try and grow these to a larger cyclotomic graph, it'll fail, it'll either be non-cyclotomic or it'll be decomposable. You just attach another connected component. I guess the thing to notice here, the EA tilde graph is almost the minimal, smallest example we see. You could just add one more vertex to this bottom chain, you get this value of lambda naught back. But it's not true that these are maximal with charged sine graphs. All of these will embed into some larger charged sine graph, so the top ones can all be found somewhere in the hypercube. We made some switching to see that. And then the AN tilde and DN tildes can all be embedded in these toroidal tessellations, these T2Ks, for a suitable value of K. So it seems that there is more to it than just you actually need at least a ring for this property of this property of hold that you can attain these extreme values of the interval if you keep growing long enough. So I guess since that's as far as I know, I should stop there and see if anyone has any questions, comments.